and whatnot. An attractive one. This is something that will stop the public in their tracks, you see. So, you know, in my own mind, I said, well, I'll have to abandon that. Maybe just go to a printer and have them print up some large scriptures, you know, large letters for some scriptures, and that should do it. So I kind of abandoned the idea, but lo and behold, as I came here, my prayer has been answered. And I want Jim Letterman to know, I want him to be acknowledged that the Lord used him in this particular respect. So we will be using this chart in about a month in the Fort Myers area in a flea market that's very, very significant. Lots of people, so we hope to get a lot of results. This is a very attractive chart, and as people go by, they're going to say, what's that all about? And that 30-minute lecture. Heaven. Future home of the overcomers. Future home of the immortals. Now, when I say future home, friends, are we talking about our future? Yours and mine? How badly do you want to go to heaven? We've got to ask that question in a very personal way. How badly do you want to see God? Is that just a casual thought in your mind? Is that a fantasy? Or is that a expectation? You know, there's power to hope. There's hope and there's power to hope. Every human being on planet Earth has hope. Hope for a better job, hope for more money, hope for the problems. Everybody's got hope. But how many have power to that hope? The power to hope is a expectation, a powerful and forceful expectation. I really expect it. This is not fantasy. I'm really going to heaven. I'm really going to see God. So how badly do you want to do that? Now, are you one of them that says, I'll go if somebody takes me? You ever hear that expression, you know, like the conventions? Are you going to Phoenix Convention? Well, I'll go if somebody takes me. Implying that if nobody takes me, I'm not going. Or are you one that will say, let me check my schedule and see if there's a weekend that I'm free? You know, we're talking about something that's real. This is a real expectation that we have as the Lord's people. We're going there. But we still stay connected to the earth. You know, it reminds me, we were in Jerusalem. And I had talked to one of the sisters there. And I said facetiously to her, it was a facetious remark. I said, sister, I says, you know, who knows? Maybe the Lord will take us all home at that point in Jerusalem. You see, because we were about 300. She says, oh no, I got to go home to close up my house. We're really saying, do you really want to see God? You know, friends, God, as I know it, as I know Him, He will give you anything you want. Anything. Provided you give Him what He wants. You name it. You want immortality? That's an awesome idea. You want immortality? He will give it to you. Provided you will give Him what He wants. You want a heavenly home? He will give it to you. Provided you give Him what He wants. This is the whole philosophy of covenants. You can name any covenant you want. And that's the whole philosophy of it. The basic idea of a covenant. You could see that in the Edenic covenant. You could see that in the Adamic covenant. And the Noahic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant. The law covenant. The Davidic covenant. The grace covenant. The new covenant, and any future covenants to come. The basic principles of covenants is if you conform to my terms, I will give you what you want. But if you break your side of the agreement and you don't uphold your side of it, then I am not obligated to uphold my side of it. You want the divine nature? What an awesome idea. You must conform to divine principles. And that's a realistic idea. That's not fantasy. That's not book religion. You know what I mean by book religion? The new creature is something real. It's alive. It's dynamic. You want the divine nature? You must start living the divine principles. If you're still living human principles, you will never become a divine person. Divine nature means you are living divine principles, the same principles that God lives. Can't be divine if you're still human. What do we know about our future home? What do we know where we'll be living in the ages to come? Does the scripture give us some insight? Now, I make no apologies for my obsession with the stars and the universe and the heavens. I'm fascinated with it. I study it. I can't stop thinking about it. It dominates my thinking. I pursue any leads that give me greater understanding of it. After all, it's my future home. I expect to spend more time in heaven than I do in New London, Connecticut. But the real obsession that I have with heaven is that God lives there. And I would like to see God. How about you? Was that just a casual thought? Oh, yeah, if it happens, it happens. Pursue it. Strive for it. The question of our future life is not merely a biblical inquiry or a convention discussion. It's a factor of reality for the new creation. The new creature within you. The world doesn't know that is real. They see you like anybody else. You're just another human being. And we don't have those outward exhibitions to tell people we're different. You know, like the white collar? You know the white collar? We look like anybody on the street. All those beautiful robes? Oh, they are beautiful. Those priests with the fancy robes. Look at our elders. They look like nobody else but people on the street. So, they can't see the new creature. But that new creature we know is alive and it's real. And it's being developed. We're in a gestation period, friends. You understand what I mean by a gestation? It's a spiritual gestation awaiting the day in which we will be born. We are spirit begotten, but we're looking for spiritual birth. So those who have the right spirit will desire to know what has the Lord in reservation for his people. It will be beyond our imagination. You know, 1 Corinthians 2:9 tells us, eye hath not seen nor heard what God has in reservation to those who are his. You know, atheists say that heaven is an illusion to spiritually intoxicated people. But you know, nobody talks more about God and heaven than those atheists who insist there is no God and there is no heaven. And the scientists, they say heaven is not knowable. Could be, they say, could not be. We don't know. We must research it, is what they're saying. But you know, Stephen Hawking, some of you may be familiar with it, he's now known as the number one scientist of today. Stephen Hawking is now talking about the universe among the universes. And he quotes Isaiah. Is that conceivable? The number one scientist of today quoting Isaiah. And as I finished his book, The Brief History of Time, he says, God fills my pages. Now, most of Christendom believe in heaven as a future home, and they proclaim that they claim that anyone who believes in Jesus will go to heaven. All you got to do is believe in Jesus and you go to heaven. But you'll note that nobody wants to die to get there. They do all kinds of things to perpetuate their human life, even though they believe in that. You know, I wanted to find out more about heaven, you know, research it, so forth. Of course, I think I'll go to the library, because there's two words that are very important. Because heaven is mentioned 587 times in the scriptures. The Hebrew word is shamoyim. Shamoyim. That's Strong's 8064. Shamoyim. And the Greek equivalent of it is oranis. Oranis. That's Strong's 3772. So I thought I'd go to the library. After all, the library should have information on heaven, shouldn't they? Well, I mean, you know, our public libraries have information on everything that's under the sun. So we have a pretty good library back home. It prides itself as having everything. So I went to the library just to see what I could find, okay? And I saw several titles over there. One was, Heaven is in Your Eye. That wasn't the book that I was going to pick up. Heaven is a Playground. These are all titles of books. Heaven is in Your Hand. Heaven and Hell as Love and War. And so on. It went on. I won't quote any more. But they're all fictitious novels. There was another one there, if I can remember. Heaven is like dancing with you. That's what the library had. Here I am with a quest for some serious information, and that's all the library had. So, having said that, the Bible is the only place. Now, I'm not saying the Koran doesn't have that and some of these others, but in our terms of our own experiences, the Bible is the only place that you'll get serious information about heaven. I'm going to make some statements about this. Now, I don't pretend to know all about heaven, but we don't see exactly everything that's there. But there's some suggestions here and there that we're going to talk about. So, they're glimpses. So, keep in mind that we're going to get some insights rather than some declarative definition. First, we have to talk about the definition of the word itself. The scriptures seem to indicate that there are five applications to heaven. The first is the physical heaven. That's in Genesis 7:11. The physical heaven. This is the region encompassing the globe, what we call the atmosphere. This is where the birds fly, the rain and the snow falls, and the planes fly. This is just the environment around heaven. This is not heaven that we're reaching for, but it's referred to heaven. Now I'm going to try to draw an illustration over here to try to get these five applications in their relationships. So the first one is heaven, the physical heaven. That's the earth. That's the atmosphere. So that's the first application of the word. The second comes from 2 Corinthians 12, 2-4. This is where Paul was transported to see and hear things which he was not permitted to reveal. It was called the third heaven. And we believe this to be the third dispensation of the plan of the ages. Basically, he was permitted to see what was going on in G. He had insights into that. And it's termed the heaven to indicate the ruling features of Christ's kingdom. Now again, this is not the heaven we're reaching for, but it's referred to as heaven. So we'll put this down as new earth. The third application is the starry heavens. This is beyond the earth and beyond the atmosphere, where the galaxies are located, where the nebulas are located, where the solar systems are located. This is where God said in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God made heaven and earth, and this is where the psalmist says, Psalms 115:15, the heavens declare the glory of God. This is the place where God numbers and names the stellar bodies. This is not heaven, but it's referred to as heaven. So that's our number three. And I'm going to draw it with a concentric circle because it is a canopy or a curtain or a veil. So that's number three, the starry heavens. Fourth application of the word is the ecclesiastical heavens. This is where Satan is referred to as the god of this world, where fallen angels are in control of human affairs. This is the heavens that will be shaken as described by Peter, so as to remove the spiritual control of earth, to make room for a new spiritual control. The celestial city of Revelation 21 comes down out of heaven to replace the ecclesiastical heavens of the god of this world. So, this again is not the heavens we're speaking of, but it's referred to as heaven. So now, where do we put Satan's heaven? You got any ideas? Well, several ideas have been proposed. Some say he's up somewhere in some stellar cluster. Some say he's on a planet somewhere. Some say he's in the middle of Earth, which is called hell. There's a wide variety of views. Where do you put Satan's heaven? I don't know about you, but I'll tell you where I put it. I put it right on this Earth. That's number four. And remember when our Lord Jesus said, he was looking at Peter and he says, "Get thee behind me, Satan." He was right there. Right there. So the ecclesiastical heavens is in and among the people. Right here on earth. The fifth and the last application of heaven. This is beyond the physical. Beyond the starry heavens. This is where Almighty God and His throne is located. This is the location of His throne, Isaiah 66:1. This is where we pray, "Our Father, which art in heaven," Matthew 6:9. It is the locations where angels descend on earth and the divine errands, Luke 22:43. This is the heavens that Jesus ascended in His resurrection, Acts 1:11. This is heaven, and we can often refer to it as the heaven of heaven. That's up here, number five. This is beyond the stair. If we think of this as the universe, our universe, we're really talking about another universe. And I like Stephen Hawking's idea. Heavens of heavens is the exact wording he uses. Another scientist calls it the universe within the universe. So this is the application of the word. But let's ask the question, where is heaven? Now we know heaven is away from earth. Because there are many scriptures that say heaven is up. Jesus, when He left the earth, He ascended up. Angels said Jesus was taken up. The church will be caught up. God sees His creatures. He looks down. When John had a vision of heaven, the angel says to come up. When the new Jerusalem comes, it comes down.
So we got that feeling that it's away from Earth at least. But you know, if you go up from China and you go up from New England, you're going to land at different locations. So Isaiah 40:14-33 speaks of God in the north parts. He's in the north parts. Well, if we draw a line toward the north, here we are in Phoenix. And we go north. So if he's in the north parts, he could be in any one of this endpoint on this line all the way up to infinity of the north. That doesn't help. It helps a little bit, but it doesn't locate it. But we find in the next series of scriptures, Isaiah 14:13, if you read that very carefully, it's about Lucifer. Let me give you some reasons of what the parts that we're talking about that has a clue. Because Lucifer said in Isaiah 14:13, I will exalt myself above the stars of God, above them. So we know at least the throne of God has got to be beyond the atmosphere, beyond the starry heavens, and somewhere beyond this and the north part. Brother, we're talking about enormous distance, awesome distance, in our term, light years, awesome, but beyond the starry heavens. Because Lucifer says, I will exalt myself above the stars, suggesting his presence is beyond. Then he says that God's heaven is spiritual. God's heaven is spiritual. So we know approximately where it is, and we also know it's spiritual. The starry heavens is not spiritual, and it's visible. In other words, God's heavens is invisible, but our universe is visible. You could see the stars. You can count them. You could see the galaxies, and you can count them. And so, therefore, anything visible is not God's heaven. It's our heaven. So we want to emphasize that, because to put God in a visible context is to start moving human parameters into the spiritual world. And then there's a third reason coming from Job 9:7, which says that God put a seal around the stars. Put a seal around the stars. What does that mean? Well, we would suggest to you it means that there is a containment, and that everything you see is like a curtain, like a veil. So that the starry heavens over here is a veil between God's heavens and the human heavens. This fourth and final reason that God's throne is beyond the stars is coming from science. Because the scientists are saying that the universe is beyond our universe. And we already talked about Stephen Hawking with his statements about the universe as being part of another universe. And there's a phenomenal concept coming out of the scientists, and that is new heavens are being created. That's with the black holes. Every galaxy has a black hole. Now some of you might ask, what's a black hole? A black hole is a star. But it's so dense, unbelievably dense, that it doesn't shed its light. It pulls its in. It pulls the light in. Not only that, but it'll pull away any weak stars that are beginning to die out. And as it pulls in these weak stars, these stars that are dying out, as it pulls them in, it begins to energize these weak stars and shoot it out the other way, because the black holes are tubular in nature. Pulls them in one area and pushes them out in another area, and those dim, dying out stars all of a sudden become vital, bright, shining stars, as if a new universe is being created. And this is how God pumps new energy into the universe, and this is how there's going to be perpetuality in the universe. It'll never die out. I would say that's an awesome design by God Himself. Awesome. And then we have the opportunity to enter that spiritual world over there, which means we have to penetrate that seal, that curtain, that veil, to reach it. But heaven is more than a place. It's a condition. Heaven is a spiritual condition. Jesus said this in John 14:2-3. In my Father's house are many mansions. I go to prepare a place for you. That the mansions refers to a level and type of spiritual life that exists in God's heaven. It's a condition of divine nature. The same nature that God has. The nature of immortality. 1 Timothy 6:16. Who only hath immortality dwelling in a light which no man can approach, which no man can see. You note in this text in 1 Timothy 6:16, gives us insight into the nature of immortality. You know, we can expect light for God. Because if I were to ask you, how do you picture God? Do you picture Him in human form? With legs and arms? And a stomach? Don't do it. Don't do it. God has no configuration along those lines. We're projecting human aspects. If there's anything you can project, it's light, brilliant light. But Paul gives us that insight, if you remember, on the road to Damascus, when he was out to go persecuting the Christians. He was stopped by a bright light. He was blinded, so we know at least it's a blinding light. Beyond that, we don't know, although I will have some comments in a moment. So we say that we know at least immortality is a form of energy, self-contained, independent energy. And this is a definition of immortality. Immortality has within itself a self-contained energy. It lives, it's self-perpetuating. Immortal beings are death-proof. They cannot die because they have this self-perpetuating life cycle. Like the galaxies with the black holes. That's self-perpetuating. That's never going to die. It's going to take the weak ones and strengthen them. So we will have this immortality. We will never burn out. The stars will never burn. The galaxies won't burn out. So immortal creatures have self-perpetuating life cycle that is independent. It doesn't depend on anything. Death is not a possibility with immortal people. But death is a possibility with mortal people. The angels can die. You can die. I can die. We are dependent on something. And in our case, we're dependent on food. Stop eating and you'll see how quick you live. I would say the same thing about the angels. But we don't know what kind of food they need. We don't know what their nutriment is. But we know they need some kind of energy to sustain them because they are mortal. You know, the scriptures speak of immortality as the prize of the overcomers. That's Philippians 3:14. I'm looking forward to being immortal. I hope you are. And you know, Romans 2:7 encourages us to seek immortality. This is not pie in the sky, friends. Let me quote the scripture. It says, to them who with patience seeks glory, honor, and immortality. The Apostle Paul is encouraging us to seek it out, meaning pursue it, go after it. It's not going to come after you, by the way, brethren. If you're going to say, here I am, seize me. It won't happen. You've got to go after it. The immortal ones will constitute the new divine family. The immortal ones would be a new creation in the universe. The immortal ones would be the initiators of a whole new series of innovation. The immortal ones, this is a mind-boggling prospect to those who will possess it. Let me make another suggestion to you about the divine family. If you will note in the king's chamber, in the pyramid, it's made up of the red granite symbolizing the divine nature, but it has five construction stones with an apex roof. This is within the pyramid on the top of the king's chamber. And each level produces these chambers. We are suggesting to you then the divine nature may have four levels. This is just a suggestion. Four levels to the divine nature. But in the top, let me see if I can draw this here. In the king's chamber, you will see so you have one, two, three, four, and five. God occupies the fifth level in the divine nature, the top level, He alone and no one else. But this is also suggesting that there might be four levels below that. Perhaps Jesus occupies the number four. And then maybe there will be special people such as the apostles in number three. And perhaps others, number two, and perhaps number... So divine nature has four levels. Now, why do we say that? Because God has used four levels in all of His other creative works. For example, the mineral level has four levels. Iron, copper, silver, and gold. The vegetable level has four levels. Mosses, grasses, shrubs, and trees. The fleshly world has four levels. Fish, fowl, animals, and humans. The spiritual level has four. Dominions, might, power, and principality. So if these are creative acts of God and they hold true, we would suggest to you four levels of the divine nature as suggested by the pyramid. And also, note the features of 1 Timothy 6:16, a light which no man can approach, whom no man has seen nor can see. Have you ever reflected what God is like? What can we expect of Him as a being? Can we expect to see this old man with a beard sitting on the throne chair? Can we expect to see the two arms that we were talking about? Or a human apparition? Friends, it's so important that we should not perceive God that way. And our Lord Jesus tells us not to. Remember what He said in Luke 24:39? The Spirit does not have flesh and bones as you see me have. And even in the throne scenes of Ezekiel, the first chapter, remember the four living creatures around the chariot throne? And then in the fourth chapter of Revelation, there were the same creatures, four creatures. We were talking about this earlier. The living creatures had two pairs of wings, each of them. There were four creatures, so that's eight. And there are six and four and four, that's 16 wings in Ezekiel, the first chapter. By the time we got to Revelation, which is roughly 1,600 years, these creatures grew an extra pair of wings. So there were six wings per creature. That's 24 wings. 16 in Ezekiel 1, but 24 wings in Revelation. Friends, you got to explain that. How come God grew some extra wings? Now, we know that doesn't mean His person. Now, we're not going to get into that because that's a subject of another discourse. But we just want to point out that He doesn't look like these wings, and we shouldn't project them. They are anthropomorphic. They are the human parameters. This is human thinking. It's not spiritual thinking. What do we know about God? As we examine some of these insights, Matthew 18:10, God has a face. Angels behold the face of the Father all the time. If God has a face, He must have other parts. Moses saw the back parts. But we have learned from the human vocabulary and language fails to accurately describe God. But the one The one area that if you want to get to know God more is when Jesus said, if you've seen me, you have seen the Father. And what he's referring to was his character. And we love to say Christ-like, friends, and we should continue saying Christ-like. I love that. But you know, friends, you know what that really is? It's God-like. He's only reflecting what God is like. So if you love the character of Jesus, and you say, I want to be like him. I want to be like him not because it's required of me, not because it's a duty, not because it's an expectation. I want to be like that because I've examined all the characters that are around me and all the characters through history, and that's the most beautiful character I can possibly possess. We want to be Christ-like and God-like because it is the most beautiful character in the universe. We can expect God to be emotional. God laughs, Psalms 2:4. God gets angry, Psalms 7:11. God hates iniquity, Psalms 5:5. God gets jealous, Exodus 34:14. God can become sad, Genesis 6:6. God is patient, Romans 8:31. If God exhibits these behaviors, does it not seem reasonable that those with the divine nature will exhibit similar behaviors? We can also expect that God is not like anything on earth. There is nothing on earth like God, except in man, his image and likeness. Genesis 1:26. Let us make man in our image and our likeness. But it didn't refer to the physical. It referred to the reasoning, the innovation, and the creating and the decision-making process. So here are the immortal qualities of the divine nature possessed by the little flock. They will be light. They will be self-perpetuating energy. They will be death-proof. They will be a part of a divine family with other immortals. They will be a new creation in the universe. They will be initiator of innovations. They will have nothing human about their nature. So stop perpetuating your humanness. You've got to give that all up. You did that at consecration, did you not? You gave it up at consecration. You're saying, I'm leaving that all behind. And I'm now looking forward to a whole new creative being. The immortals will have a face. The divine nature will have a face. They will evaporate. They will be emotional. Emotions pretty much like we have. But if you can't control your emotions here right now, you're not living those divine principles. I want to emphasize that point because that's a critical point. You want the divine nature, you must be practicing those divine principles. Because once you get a divine body, you're going to see yourself... Is it that soon? You will see yourself dealing with the problems you are now with these emotions and with these problems. If you can't control them now, you might say, well, then it will be easier. I think it is. But the Lord is not going to give you an incompatible body. He's not going to put an imperfect character into a perfect divine body. That's mismatched. What else do we know about heaven? It's the residence of God. Heaven is where God rules the universe. Heaven contains 24 thrones around a central throne suggesting an organization. Heaven also has the Lamb. He is there. Heaven contains many angelic beings. Heaven also has some form of music. I think Tim Krupa might be interested in that. But it's not like the music you hear here, even though that's beautiful. You know why? Because the music we have here is part of the air. There's no air. You know, you only hear what goes on here because of air. The vibration that goes, you know, as I was listening to the Austin brothers. When they string those guitars, all they were doing was rarefacting or creating vibrations in the air, and the air came to us and we picked it up. But if there's no air, you wouldn't hear anything. There's no air in heaven, so it must be a different kind of music. I would suggest it's going to be far more beautiful than the music you hear here. So, heaven has some form of music. Heaven has a language that is distinct from the human language. I got scriptures for all this, but I'm going to try to save some time. Heaven has no need for sleep. Oh, that's great. And if they hold conventions in heaven, there won't be anybody sleeping in the convention. The divine ones live 24 hours a day, continuously, day in and day out, without any need for sleep. Heaven is reunion. Reunion. We will know as we are known. This reunion of the overcomers. I think of reunion often. We're going to see people that have passed beyond the veil. We will see all the heroes of the Bible. You know, I'm anxious to meet Cornelius. My Italian counterpart. I want to congratulate him for being the very first Gentile convert. I'm looking forward to talking to the Apostle Paul. I got a lot of questions for the Apostle Paul. I'm looking to talk to Peter. Now, was he really crucified upside down? A lot of questions I have. The Urim and the Thummim. How did that really work? Because it's such a mystery now. How about Thomas? I want to ask if Thomas really was the Hebrew that went to India. We have a lot of questions in this reunion. So heaven is a time of reunion. What a wonderful prospect. And those of you who have lost loved ones, can you imagine you will meet them again? I can't wait to meet some of the friends that have gone beyond the veil. Let me conclude with a story. It's the parable of the ladder to reach heaven. Maybe some of you heard it, but let me get everybody on board. Once there was a woman that dreamed of a ladder that reached from earth to heaven. And she saw many angels ascending and descending this ladder. She also saw many humans climbing up the ladder. And she was surprised to see some of her friends go up the ladder to heaven. But she saw a lot of people she never knew. Then in her dream, she was overjoyed to see herself climb up the ladder. And so she began to climb up the ladder. But in her dream, she turned as she was climbing, and she looked down, and she saw beautiful things. Oh, the first thing she saw was the houses and the trees. It captivated her. And you can imagine going up, you know, 50 feet above, and you're looking at the houses and the gardens and the lawn and so forth and the street. Captivated her, and it slowed it up a little bit. But then she continued climbing, but much slower than before. And she looked out again, and there she was enchanted with the Greek valleys and the running streams and the beautiful clouds. This time she really slowed up. But she saw the beautiful gardens and all of the things that one would see. But then it slowed her up, but then she continued on. But now she was really looking back. He was looking back as to what she left. But this time she was at a higher... Then she saw the skyscrapers. She saw the network of streets, and she saw the cars. She saw the Grand Canyon. Beautiful. Here she stopped at the ladder. She stared and stared, and in her dream, she settled down on this spectacular view. She was mesmerized with this view. Then in her dream, there was a clap of thunder, a bolt of lightning, and the ladder started to crumble. And she collapsed, and she fell to the earth in her dream. And she woke up from the dream shaking, sweating, broken, disappointed. For in her dream, the ladder from earth to heaven no longer existed. For in her dream, she didn't make it. She failed to make it. For in her dream, she tarried. She was preoccupied with the visible, with the natural. For in her dream, she lost the heavenly vision. And then she reflected. When will we ever learn that we have been given a ladder to reach heaven? We must seize the opportunity now while it is still there. What we're saying, friends, that ladder is going to be removed. She reflected, when will we ever learn that we must climb the ladder in haste, as one day it will collapse? She reflected, when are we ever going to learn we must climb the ladder and not be distracted by the earthly view? She reflected, when will we ever learn we must climb the ladder with singleness of purpose or lose forever this glorious prospect of being in the family of immortals? When will we ever learn? Incidentally, the woman in the dream was related to Lot's wife. May God help us to climb this ladder with unswerving purpose.